Hi, this is Tess Vigeland, and you're listening to the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 7th, 2010. You know, a huge part of our economy is tied to the amount of money that you and I spend. And as the Great Recession got underway, people stopped spending, and they started saving quite a bit. But did it stick? Maybe not.
I think the difference going forward is instead of shopping till we drop, we'll probably shop till we're tired.
Yeah, probably. At least that. And meanwhile, when you've had 100 birthdays, it's hard to keep track of all the candles on the cake.
How old are you?
I don't know. I don't count anymore. Judy, you know how old I am?
You're 102.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is interesting. You've got to stay tuned to hear that story. But first, with all the wild stock market gyrations this week, it was nice to end with some calm on the jobs front. Employers added 290,000 positions to their payrolls in April, but 15 million people are still out of work, and many of them are counting on unemployment checks to get by. How long you're allowed to collect those benefits depends on the unemployment rate in your state. The longest is 99 weeks. Unless Congress keeps extending that, people across the country will start to fall off the rolls. Shawnette Daniel is one of those people. She is close to maxing out her benefits in Utah. She's got about $250 a week.
We're getting close to falling behind on our mortgage payment. We've already cut back about as far as we can on any extraneous expenses. We even have backyard chickens and a larger garden this year. Basically, I guess we'll see what it means when it runs out.
Where were you working before you lost your job?
I was working at Whole Foods.
And how does the unemployment check compare to what you were making there?
It's just over half of what I was making per month, so that's quite a difference.
What are your prospects for getting a job in the near future?
I have applied for waitress jobs and go through the interview, and they're very polite and let me know that they wish me luck, but I'm overqualified and they're worried, you know, if they hire me that I'm going to leave the minute the economy turns around or I find a better job. And I can't argue really with them because it's true.
So you're finding it hard to get a job because you're overqualified?
Right. And then the jobs that I normally would hold aren't available.
What's your response to those who say that unemployment benefits are a disincentive to look for work?
I would say that they're actually a double incentive to look for work, because every week that I'm not making near what I'm used to making and bringing in the income that supports our family drives me even harder to look for any way to fulfill my part of supporting our family until the economy does turn around.
Well, Shawnette, best of luck to you. And will you let us know how things are going? Keep us up to date.
I most certainly will. Thank you so much.
I mentioned that debate over how long to extend unemployment benefits. In fact, there is talk in Congress that there will be no more extensions, that the money needs to instead to go toward job creation. We wanted to hear both sides of that debate. So I'm now joined by economist Heather Boucher of the Center for American Progress and James Shirk, an economist at the Heritage Foundation. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Thanks for having us on.
Heather, let's start with you. Can you give us a snapshot of the unemployment insurance situation out there today? 99 weeks going to be the limit?
Well, that's the limit right now. In normal times, folks can only receive unemployment insurance benefits for 26 weeks. Mm-hmm. That is about 6 months. And for the past couple of years, we've been extending it and allowing people to receive benefits for longer because the labor market is just so bad.
Now, James, do you think we're done with extensions at this point, especially leading up to the midterm elections?
No, I don't think Congress is likely to draw back on the extensions anytime soon. It's a situation where you have, as Heather said, a much worse labor market. And so it's natural to have extensions above and beyond the normal 6 months. The question is just how much above and beyond is appropriate.
Well, what do you think are some of the benefits and drawbacks of that limit?
The benefits are quite obvious of having extended unemployment insurance is that it acts as an insurance against the quite painful event of losing your job and having to find new income. You want to be able to make your mortgage payments and pay your bills while that's going on. It also has a drawback. Those who are unemployed and have the UI benefits are more selective about the jobs they search for. They look for jobs that are more close to home. And then when the benefits run out, they then take jobs in different industries or in different states. that's a cost. It would be better for the workers in the economy if they were willing to, say, take a job in Nebraska or North Dakota in another state and move immediately, rather than wait a year and a half on the UI benefits and then in the final 6 months make the move that they would have had to make anyway.
Heather, what's your take on this argument that the longer folks stay on unemployment insurance, perhaps the less incentive they have to get off?
First and foremost, we're in an economy where there's more than five workers seeking every new job opening available. So the idea that somehow if we cut off folks' benefits or gave them fewer weeks that they would just magically find jobs even if they moved is really just a fallacy. But I also want to touch on one point that James made, that we do know, you know, as folks have these benefits, it gives them the opportunity to search for jobs that are a more appropriate match. I disagree very strongly with the characterization that these workers are somehow more selective and that's a bad thing. And actually, in many ways, it's a good thing because you want someone who's lost a job with this particular skill set to be able to have some time to search for a new job using the skills that they have. That is good for our economy. That builds productivity.
But should there be any limit? 99 weeks is almost 2 years. How long do you keep extending those benefits?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, and it may sound like a long time for those of us, quite frankly, who are lucky enough to have our jobs right now. But for those folks who are out of work and are experiencing record high durations of unemployment, newsflash, we haven't started creating the kinds of jobs yet that can get folks back into work. So I think the appropriate question isn't how long do we make individuals go with or without benefits? The question is, how are we going to get jobs created? Then we can start saying, okay, well, there's jobs coming back. People are going to find them. They won't need these extended benefits.
James, what about Heather's argument? What's your response to that?
Take a worker in Detroit who's lost his job. He had a job with the UAW and then General Motors. Those jobs simply aren't coming back. You can give him 2 years of unemployment insurance. You can give him 10 years. He's still not going to find another job earning the same UAW wages he had. And the question is, how do we respond to that? You can give the workers unemployment insurance for 2 years and postpone the problem. But it's not helpful.
Heather, what does the recovery look like if there are no more extensions?
Well, I think that that would be the kind of thing that could slow down this nascent recovery, quite frankly. Over the past few months, we've seen them vote repeatedly for 1 or 2 month extensions and then sort of take it right down to the wire or, in fact, let it lapse for a couple of days, as happened last time, leaving Department of Labor's around the country in quite a muddle as to whether or not people are going to get these extended benefits. That's been a real problem for folks out there and for the administration. It's highly inefficient. So we need to make sure that those extended benefits continue to be approved by Congress, and the next one is up on June 2nd, so that's coming up quite soon.
If there is no extension beyond this 99 weeks, and you have a lot of folks with no income whatsoever, what is another solution for them?
The ultimate solution to this is more job creation on the part of entrepreneurs and businesses and enterprises as they have more productive projects they can engage in. And we should be looking for policies that create more of those opportunities. That's good for the economy and it creates jobs. It's a win-win scenario. That's the best solution going forward.
Heather Boucher is with the Center for American Progress, and James Shirk is an economist at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you both. I appreciate the debate, and I think it was a good one.
Thank you. It's been quite a pleasure.
Thank you for having us on.
I was in an Apple store last weekend. The place was packed, and every customer asking for a new 3G iPad got the same answer. Sold out. That was the refrain across the country, apparently. $500? No problem. Here's my wallet. What recession, right? Well, purchases like that are part of why a new number out this week shows we spent more than we made in March. Economist Joel Naroff is here to help explain. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure being with you, Tess.
So are you joining all these other folks and doing a little more spending than normal lately?
I'm spending a little bit more, actually getting a couple of things done on my house that I've put off for a couple of years. But I'm not out there spending like crazy, that's for certain.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. But, you know, here we are less than 2 years out from the heart of the economic crisis. Supposedly we were all going to learn a big lesson, cut back on our overspending. What's your sense of the situation right now?
Well, I think what's happening is people have learned a little bit of a lesson. They've discovered over the last 2 years or so that if they don't visit the malls, they can do without it. If they don't go out to eat every night, that's not the worst thing possible. And they've learned to cut back to some extent. But I think that's going to change a little bit. We're a consuming nation. We like to shop. I think the difference going forward is instead of shopping till we drop, we'll probably shop till we're tired.
Until the feet are ready to go, right?
That's right. But that's really a big difference because we were a little crazy in the 90s and especially the past decade where we had an awful lot of extra income from either dot-coms or, you know, raiding our equity in our homes, and we went out and spent like crazy. We don't have that anymore. That by itself is going to keep spending down. Even if we want to go out, we just don't have the cash or the income.
Well, does this also give lie to the idea that this is a consumer-less recovery? I mean, it's certainly still a jobless recovery, but aren't consumers now adding to the sense that things are getting better?
Well, consumers are spending a little bit more, but I think we have to keep it in perspective. If you go back a year ago, we were all assuming what I nicknamed the turtle position, where we just basically pulled in our heads and our legs and said, I'm not doing anything, I'm not going anywhere, I'm just trying to survive. What we're seeing now is the slow but steady progress back to what will ultimately be normal, whatever that may be. It's clearly going to be a lot more savings than we had been, but I don't think we're going to go back to the time where we're saving 10, 15% of our income. If we save 5, 6% of it, that would be an awful lot. But again, because we don't have that extra money to redo our kitchens and our bathrooms and to buy new cars and things like that, we're going to be spending significantly less over the next few years.
Well, given that our spending has ticked up a bit, why do you think we think things are better? What's the signal been?
Well, I think the key really is the job market itself. And while we're not seeing a whole lot of jobs being created, they're slowly coming back, there's no question, but we've got a long way to go. You know, I used to make the comment that if you look to your left and you look to your right and you saw that one of the people next to you were gone, you got really worried. When you saw they were both gone, you got panicked. Well, what's happening now is that after all the cutbacks we got last spring, people are looking to their left and looking to their right, and they're seeing that the people they're left working with are still there. The cutbacks are not causing people to be as fearful as they had been because they're not happening anymore. Right now, I think people are much less worried about losing their job than they had been, and that's why confidence is beginning to pick up. And that's one of the key reasons why I think we're seeing a little bit more spending, because they're not as fearful about losing their jobs.
Joel Naroff is the president and founder of Naroff Economic Advisors. Thanks so much. It's been fun talking to you.
It's always a pleasure, and thanks for having me, Tess.
In a recession, a lot can change from the time you apply for financial aid to when you actually get the money.
I've spoken to mothers who said, I'm getting ready to be evicted, but I don't want my child to know. Please don't tell my child.
How to appeal your aid package, next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time for that part of the show where we take on your questions. And here with me to do that this week is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
How are you doing, Tess?
I am doing well, but let me ask you a question. How well do you think the efforts on financial reform are doing? Because, my friend, I am really, really losing any sort of positive outlook I had on this.
Well, then let me give you something of a positive outlook, because
okay,
I think
good.
It's two
Thank
steps
you.
Forward, one step back. It's better than the existing system. The rules and regulations, which are still being negotiated, will be better than what we had.
But then it sounds like you actually have confidence that there will be reform.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question there will be reform. But here's what I worry about. It all involves the too big to fail firms. These are global companies. They do business in Asia, in Latin America, Europe, Japan, and here.
And you're talking about the likes of like J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup and all those folks.
And Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
So these firms, if the rules are not global, regulation ultimately will fail. So what everyone needs to watch when the rules are passed, and I do believe we will have regulatory reform out of Washington, D.C., everyone then should shift their focus to Switzerland. I'm not kidding. 27 nations are there negotiating the international rules. and it really matters.
So you don't want to have different rules here and then different rules for the rest of the world?
No, not at all. Because these are global firms and, you know, they'll transfer a little bit of business that we say you can't do here. Yeah, okay, no problem. Lombard Street, London. I'll move over there.
In the meantime, shall we shift our focus to Greensboro, North Carolina?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's where Samantha is. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. How are you guys doing today?
Very well. And you?
I'm good.
Yeah? What do you do there in North Carolina?
I work in a restaurant, Bar and Grill.
What's your favorite dish there?
Oysters Rockefeller or shrimp cocktail.
Ooh, yes. Well, you're in a seafood state, so I can certainly understand that.
How are the tips?
Actually, I work in the kitchen. I don't wait tables.
Ooh, you're a cook?
I am.
Very good. How long have you been doing that?
About 7-8 years now. I started when I was 14 working in Papa John's.
Is this one of those things where you had a really good cook for a mother or father and you thought, hey, I want to do that?
No, actually, neither of my parents can cook.
It was the opposite incentive.
So what do you want to do with your career then?
I would like to own my own restaurant.
Oh, boy. You know, I hear that opening a restaurant is one of the more futile efforts in life. So why would you want to do this?
Well, I think it really depends on the type of person who's going to open it up. I've got a lot of experience from front of the house to back of the house. I love doing it. And I mean, I've never sent out anything to anybody they haven't told me wasn't absolutely delicious. So I think I got a better shot than most people.
Well, have you looked into this at all then? And what have you found?
Well, I'm actually looking at two options right now. I'm either trying to open up a small hot dog cart, which I already have the startup money to do and everything to get that going. But at the same time, I'm also looking at possibly opening my own restaurant, getting a building, leasing it out, buying equipment.
What does it cost to start up a hot dog cart?
Right now, I've already found a cart I can buy and looked into all the permits. It's right around $1,000 to $1,200.
Okay.
And what does it cost to start up a restaurant?
About $80,000.
Okay. Well, we have a really, really big difference there. So
it's a huge difference.
So what's your question for us then?
I'm actually wondering, considering my age, would it be better for me to go ahead and start a small business that I already have the capital for and I'm not going to kind of, you know, lose my shirt in? Or because I'm so young, maybe I should go ahead, jump out, get the loan, and start a business.
And you're 23 again?
Yes, sir.
Is that right? 23, okay.
Oh, that's a great question. And I'm going to tell you right to the bottom line, I'd go with the hot dog cart. You know, it's going to be fun. It's an experience. It's a real-world experience. It's that difference from being a manager, an employee, to running your own business.
So it's a good way to learn experience before jumping into a big restaurant.
Absolutely. I mean, $80,000 is a lot of money. And the way that restaurants are funded, you know, no bank is going to lend you much money for a restaurant, if any money. The best way to be starting a restaurant is you start with your family, your friends. You got to, you know, raise some equity. I just think with the hot dog stand, you can do a little bit of experimentation. You add to your stock of knowledge. And it also gives you a really good story when it comes time for you to run your own restaurant or to raise money for your restaurant. It's an incredible story.
Chris, what about this question? And I think it applies kind of beyond Samantha's situation. Do you take a risk early in life where you have a lot of time to make up for it if you fail? Or do you start small and wait until later on, get the big dream later, but then you don't have a whole lot of time to make up for it if it doesn't work out?
You know, I think if you don't take the risks when you're young, you typically don't take the risks when you're older.
Hmm.
But I just recommend jumping in there, being an entrepreneur, but let's be sensible about the downside risk as you embrace this lifestyle.
What do you think, Samantha?
Good advice. I think I'm well on my way to making a decision.
All right. Well, good luck and let us know if how that hot dog stand goes for you.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
If you've got questions, do give us a call. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can always write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And next, Elizabeth is with us from Dana Point, California. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Boy, you are in a beautiful area of the country.
Yes, I think so.
How long have you lived in Dana Point?
About 25 years.
25 years. That's a long time. And what do you do there?
I'm a breakfast cashier at the local elementary school.
You're the cafeteria lady.
Yes. That's
oh, do they make you wear a hairnet?
No, they don't. No, just the apron.
Any of your own kids that come through the line there?
No, I have a freshman at UCLA and a junior at the high school.
Ah, so may I guess that you may have a question about student loans?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, boy. What kind of situation are you in at this point?
Well, I was wondering whether I should pay my tax man to fill out my FAFSA, because if he does, he will not list my rental properties as assets. And it would sincerely lower my expected family contribution.
Okay, I'm confused already. Let's back this one up. You are looking at potentially wanting to get student loans from the government.
Yes.
And your tax accountant has suggested that you do something funky with the FAFSA form?
That I don't list my rental properties in my asset column because I don't make a profit on them.
Hmm. What kind of rental properties do you have?
There's two locally in Dana Point, and there is a lot of equity on them. And the taxman said, oh, you don't need to list them. And my Wells Fargo banker said the same thing. Just don't include those in your asset column. If we do that, then the kids would qualify for student loans.
Chris, does this sound on the up and up to you?
Yeah, just a couple. Are these rental properties, are they a corporation, subchapter S, limited liability company?
No, they're just our second and third homes that we own and rent out.
Okay. On the advice that you're getting, it's a really gray area when you come into rental properties. Let's say it was a vacation home, just to use as an example. It was a vacation home that you rented out most of the time, but you used it every once in a while. That is supposed to go under your asset column. But if it's a business, it would be excluded. You don't have to put it down as an asset, just as you don't have to put down your own home where you live or the family farm. The advice that you're getting is not trying to play games. There is debate.
Okay. We are not earning income off of these properties. We operate them at a loss.
At a loss? Does that make a difference, Chris?
Well, the thing is, if you didn't list them as an asset, but you were making money, it's still going to show up in the FAFSA form on the income side. But in this particular case, by not listing as an asset and not earning income off of it, it's simply not going to show up.
So, Elizabeth, what do you think you'll do?
Well, I think I should stay honest and list them, because when you click on the FAFSA form button, it says list your assets and it names equity in your rental properties.
Yeah.
But if he's telling me it's a business, then I'm even more conflicted.
Yes, and you can read a section, by the way. One of the websites that I love is a website called finaid.org, and it's a great one. And they have a long discussion there of the small business exclusion. Take a look, and you may come out of that and say, hey, this is a business. Or you may say, well, under these guidelines, this explanation, you know what? I'm going to put it under the asset column.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Elizabeth.
All right. Thank you very much.
And David is now on the line with us. He's in San Diego, California. Hi, David.
Hi.
Got any kids in college?
Many, many years away.
Many, many years away. So yeah. You have a young child then?
Yeah, we have a two-year-old right now.
Ah, and are you starting to save for college yet?
That is hopefully next on the line. after we deal with what I called in about today. So my wife and I purchased a house in suburbs of San Diego about 2 years ago.
2 years ago? This isn't starting out well.
Oh, no, it's not. It's not that bad.
No, it's all right. I mean, that was the height of the housing market.
No, it was actually, we purchased our current house at a very good price. And our plan was, we're going to do a lot of work on the house. We're going to fix it up and then stay there. My family lives very close. Her family lives very close.
That's
perfect.
Nice.
We're kind of right where we want to be.
Sounds great.
So we've done a lot of work on the house. I did a lot of work myself.
And how was the whole DIY thing for you?
I get a kick out of it. I'm very capable, but you definitely get sold something watching these DIY shows that isn't necessarily true. You know, they don't show the seven professionals behind the camera who are working 24-hour days to get these jobs done in a weekend.
Yeah. See, I want those seven professionals. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, me too.
And I realized it's going to cost twice as much as your original estimate, but it's going to take 3 to 4 times as long.
Yeah, and it sounds also like you didn't have any trouble getting financing for that.
No, we didn't. Our initial idea was, when we bought the house and we got a good price on it, was that we were going to do this work on it, and then we were going to refinance the whole package back into a nice lower rate, 30-year fixed.
So what then went wrong? How can we help you?
Well, something interesting happened along the way. We had gotten a financing package through Wells Fargo, and at some point, we received a couple of phone calls from different local Wells Fargo branches, from financing officers we think that we could, you know, help you out and get you refinanced into a better rate than what you're doing now. And so we got two of those back to back, one to me, one to my wife. We just agreed to start a dialogue. Oh yeah, refinancing is something we're interested in doing, and we'll talk to you later about it. And then we received a letter in the mail from Wells Fargo, a corporate office, saying that it says that they have given our request for a credit account most careful consideration. As much as we would love to serve your credit needs, we are unable to do so at this time. Well, I don't remember applying for credit. Do you remember applying for credit?
Oh, boy.
And so what we're trying to figure out is, did this local person decide to take matters in their own hand and start things going without our approval?
Right.
Mm. Good question. And you have actually sent us a copy of this letter. Chris, you have that in front of you. This raised some red flags for you?
I would put a stop to it. You didn't get a loan taken out. You didn't sign any papers. But still, let's put a stop to this whole thing, don't you think?
What's the best way to do that, Chris?
Okay, well, first of all, it turns out that Wells Fargo, because I did get in touch with Wells Fargo, that they have a do not call list. And I think that David should be on the do not call list.
Okay.
But Chris, since they are interested in refinancing, what's the best way to do that at this point?
Right. Well, they're, in terms of the refinancing, then I'd actually would walk down to the branch and sit down and say, here's the situation. And by the way, I'm looking you right in the eye. This is what I don't want to have happen. This is what just happened. It's unacceptable. We're going to be talking about refinancing and what kind of deal can you do for me? And by the way, I don't want to hear from any other branches. I don't want to hear from anybody else from Wells Fargo. All right? I'm a good customer. And then you go to another bank or a credit union. Credit unions are very, very competitive these days. Community banks. There's lots of options out there. How about just staring them right in the eye and have a conversation and lay out your expectations?
Boy, that's something new and different. Actually go in and see the bank man.
You know, I have near where I work, there's a Wells Fargo branch, and there's all kinds of loan officers there. So, you know,
okay,
make them work.
Thanks for the call, David.
Thank you for your help.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can email your question at the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much for helping us out today.
It was fun, Tess.
And remember to check with your own financial expert before making any big money decisions. Parents of college-age kids, this is an especially stressful time of year. Got to figure out how to pay the tuition bill. Most families have already received their financial aid offers. If it's not enough, they might try to appeal. But there are very specific reasons why a school might consider such an appeal. Pam Fowler is the director of financial aid at the University of Michigan, where they've seen a nearly 50% spike in appeals. Pam, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could explain the value of appealing a financial aid package, because it seems to me that for most families, I mean, they're throwing everything at you in the first place. So is it worth trying to appeal what you've been given?
Well, I think we use the word appeal differently in the general public than we do in the financial aid office. When we talk about an appeal, we're speaking of something that has happened to the family that it was not reflected on the application. Someone has lost a job, someone has downsized, someone who owned their own business has had to declare bankruptcy. Those are the kinds of things that we speak of in the aid community when we talk about appealing a financial aid award.
What information are you looking for as a financial aid officer?
We have to, under federal regulations, document whatever changes we make and the reason for making those changes. So if a parent was laid off, then we just need a letter from the employer that says, this person was laid off effective this date. And then we also would like to have from that family their unemployment income and how long that unemployment income is expected to last. If the family has medical expenses, then we would like to see those unpaid medical bills. And we always ask the family to give us an estimate of what you think your income will be for a 12-month period.
What kind of information is of no use?
If you're in high debt because you bought a boat or that kind of thing, we're not interested in that. But we're looking at the fact that you're in debt through unusual circumstances or circumstances that were beyond your control at that point in time.
Do you find
at all that it's difficult for the parents to go through an appeal process?
I think sometimes it's difficult for parents to ask, and sometimes it's difficult for the family to tell the student. I've spoken to mothers who said, I'm getting ready to be evicted, but I don't want my child to know. Please don't tell my child.
Wow.
And so I have to say to the parent, you need to tell your student that this is what's happening. But I will work with the parent, and I will say, well, you give me the documentation that says you've lost your home, and I will make the adjustment. But the student's going to want to know why all of a sudden they've gotten more financial aid. So you're only prolonging a conversation that you need to have.
What would you say is the most important tip, perhaps, that you can give to a family that is really worried they're not going to be able to send the kid to college?
Well, I think the family needs to discuss this. The student needs to discuss this with a financial aid advisor so that we can explain the options that that student and family have. In some cases, we can do a lot. In some cases, we can't do very much at all. If you're very, very high income, there's very little that we can do. We had many upper income families that took hits last year. We had families who had, you know, invested all their money with Madoff and they lost it all. But there's also institutional money. And the institution may have set aside additional funds, as we did at the University of Michigan, to help families in this situation. So you need to ask, and you need to put all your cards on the table, and then we can come back to that family and say, here are the options.
Pam Fowler is the Director of Financial Aid and, I presume, a proud Wolverine at the University of Michigan.
That's correct.
Thanks so much for your help.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We are always preaching the gospel of retirement planning. Pay yourself first so you can enjoy those golden years. But what if you live well beyond what you budgeted for?
Well, very frankly, Tordy ran out of money when she was 98.
Managing the dollars and cents of a centenarian, coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Boundless opportunities exist in life for awkward conversations with your parents. It starts with the birds and the bees, continues through emergency withdrawals from the bank of mom and dad, and then there's the, sorry, we're taking the kids to the in-laws for the holidays talk. It doesn't get any easier as we get older. In fact, one of the most difficult versions of the talk is the one where you have to ask your aging parents if they need help managing their money. Ben Calhoun has our story.
A few years back, Eva Mendoza was taking care of her mother, Maria, who was in the earliest stages of dementia. Eva spent years working as a bookkeeper, and she was looking over her mother's finances when she noticed a problem.
I noticed that her rent was not being paid, her phone bill wasn't being paid.
But it wasn't just that. There was money missing, a lot of money.
She told me that the bank was stealing her money.
That didn't sound right to Eva.
So I went to the bank with her, and the bank teller, she knew me for a long time, so she took out the withdrawal slips, and she showed them to me.
And then the teller turned to Eva's mother.
And she told my mother, you know that you come here and you keep withdrawing money.
Eva's mother had been going to the bank with someone and withdrawing hundreds of dollars at a time. The teller knew who it was, too. It was Eva's niece, her mother's own granddaughter.
And if you see her, you think she's an angel.
Eva was angry at her niece, upset her mother had been taken advantage of, and she dreaded what she knew was going to be a tough conversation with her mom.
I told her, I said, listen, something is happening here. And I have to take over.
Her mother resisted, but eventually agreed. Eva assumed power of attorney and set up a bank account for her mom. She arranged for her mother's Social Security to go directly into that new account. now that she controls her mother's finances, she's been able to protect her from relatives who still, to this day, come asking for money.
Oh, you know, I have to do groceries and I didn't have enough money. Oh, the rent I didn't pay this month. So she'll tell them, I don't have any money. You know, Eva's the one that has my money.
Seniors face a variety of financial threats, from family members who take advantage of them to a wide range of con artists. On the FBI's website, there are 8 different kinds of schemes seniors are warned to look out for, from phony anti-aging products to funeral and cemetery fraud. Senior service experts say their advice for adult children is to talk to your parents about their finances. Eleanor Ginsler is a VP at AARP and an expert on parental caregiving.
There's an immense amount of concern about even broaching this kind of a topic among families. People don't like having these conversations anyway about what do we do if you need help, mom and dad. The financial part of that conversation is likely the most difficult one.
Ginsler says talking about money can be hard. It can bring out trust issues in a family, hostility, insecurities. But it's also possible to avoid those things or overcome them.
The sad truth is that it's critically important to open these lines of communication across the generations. And if you don't engage in these conversations early, you're going to actually end up in what can be a far more problematic situation later on.
As for Eva Mendoza, she says today when she thinks about what happened to her mother, she still feels angry. She also says she does often wonder if she'd talked to her mother earlier about her money, if maybe, just maybe, she could have stopped things sooner. In New York, I'm Ben Calhoun for Marketplace Money.
One of the big questions, of course, is when you start talking to your parents about their money situation, when they're 60, 70. I haven't had the talk with my folks yet. They're in their mid-60s and as sharp as ever. But I watched as my mother took over her parents' finances. It was difficult because they lived quite a bit longer than they had planned for. Her father, my granddad, lived to be 91, her mom, 87, and they'd only done the math for living into their early 80s. It's a situation more of us may find ourselves in as medical advances keep us alive longer, even past the century mark, Sally Herships reports.
Hortense Gutman lives in Westchester, New York. She's got kids, grandkids, and even great-grandkids. She's what you might call a woman of a certain age.
How old are you?
I don't know. I don't count anymore. Judy, you know how old I am?
You're 102.
Oh, that's interesting.
Everyone calls her Horty, even her daughter Judy, who's visiting from out of state. Her son Steve and his wife are visiting, too.
Hello, Mother.
Hi, honey.
Horty lives in the Sarah Newman Nursing Home.
Go fly with me.
The day I visit, there's a concert on the first floor. It's sunny, and there are movie posters on the walls of Cary Grant and Betty Davis. Horty's been living here for almost 5 years. She has a roommate, but before she moved in, at 98, she lived on her own for 30 years. She worked until her 70th birthday.
And I made no move to retire, but the next month they said, you know, you're not on the payroll anymore. So that was my introduction to retirement.
Now her daughter Judy is retired. She's 69, and she tells me she's followed all the rules for preparing for old age. She's got Social Security and a pension.
So far, it's worked out okay, but if I live to be 100, I don't know what the future holds.
The reason Judy's uncertain is because of what her mother went through. Horty's son Steve says his mom followed all the rules, as well as she could. Horty was widowed when she was 40, with 2 young kids, and options like long-term care insurance didn't exist back then. Steve says a lot of long-term care policies that exist today have a limited duration.
That policy is only good for a few years. So even if one prepares by having such a policy, if you're lucky, like my mom, you can outlive the policy.
It turns out that Horty was lucky and unlucky at the same time. Most people would agree that you're lucky if you live for a century. And Horty's family feels fortunate to still have her, but there is a downside.
As people get older and they need to have help in the house, it's harder to prepare for those things until it's too late.
She couldn't walk. That was the problem. She was starting to lose her ability to walk.
That's Steve's wife, also Judy. She says eventually Horty needed help going shopping, even to visit the doctor across the street.
If there was a Victorian family, then grandma could be in the house and she'd be taken care of. But that's not the way people live today.
Someone slept at the house with her. Do you remember what that woman was paid?
It came up to, it was a lot of money.
$20,000 a year. It wasn't that Horty was unprepared for old age. She'd saved and had a small pension from her job. But the older she got, the higher the cost of help became. Eventually, round-the-clock care was costing her $30,000 a year. It was just too much.
Well, very frankly, Horty ran out of money when she was 98.
Steve says she had to apply for Medicaid, which felt like applying for welfare.
Now I know that in that red pack on the table is...
The brownies.
Yes, it is. Judy brought in that pack. It's got the kind of cake I like, you know.
In the end, turning 100 cost Horty Guttman every cent she'd saved. And in a way, she got lucky again, because now the government picks up most of the tab for her. So she's able to enjoy a life that cost her hardly anything. I asked her what's left on her budget.
Well, really, very little.
How about clothing? We do buy new clothing.
What, honey?
We do buy new clothing for you.
Oh, well, yes, you do.
Right.
And they do it very well, thank you. I can say, I need blah, 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 and I get blah, blah, blah. Now, that's a very good arrangement for me.
It's unusual for people to live to be 100. But I told Horty, experts think most kids today will make it to that age. So, did she have any advice for them? How much should they save?
Depends on your taste, kids.
In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Even if a relative does make it to 100, they're not going to be around forever. And when they do pass on, family members are often left with years, even decades, of treasures, heirlooms, and, let's face it, junk. In Lisa Tracy's new book, The Objects of Our Affection, she talks about the stories we invest in those things our loved ones leave behind, stories that make it hard to ever get rid of them. For instance, her nephew's thoughts on an old milk bottle.
One night, his dad was making popcorn in a skillet, and when he took it off the stove and opened the lid, the fluffed kernels exploded all over the place. And when the popcorn blew up, says my great-nephew, I was looking at the milk bottle, and it put the remembering right in my head. The memory still makes him laugh uproariously. And this is why, I see, we won't be getting rid of this milk bottle anytime soon.
Tracy ended up with storage lockers full of stuff from her family's past when her mother died. Some of it valuable, some of it not so much. So for this Mother's Day weekend, we talked with her about her new book, which tells of the struggle she faced in both keeping and selling her mom's things.
When I was doing some research for the book, according to one study I saw, Americans spend $20 billion a year on storage units. And another study said that the average American moves 11 times in a lifetime. And I really think this is a part of the crux of this whole possessions issue that I think Americans have. Mm. Because we move so much, we do carry things with us, and they sort of become almost our home.
Well, in the book, you detail how you and your sister wound up with a storage locker full of stuff from your family's past.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that space.
We actually had two bins, which of course were piled to the ceiling, everything carefully put on top of everything else. But this was because my mom had died in the early 1990s, and my sister and I were kind of in, you know, grief and denial, and we both lived in other parts of the country. So we just kind of, in an emergency measure, sort of threw the stuff into storage and then went away. The storage bins were only a couple $100 a month, which each time you pay it doesn't seem like that much. But then eventually we had spent about $10,000 in increments of 1 month at a time, because years went by. And finally I went and checked the bins and I saw some evidence of some mouse damage and stuff. And that's when I called my sister and I said, what are we doing? This is crazy.
So was it mostly the cost that was weighing on you at that point, or was there anything in the back of your head that said, you know, this is stuff that belonged to my parents, maybe I should go through it?
Absolutely. It wasn't even so much the cost, although when I stopped and realized that in these little sort of innocent increments we had spent all this money. Mm-hmm. But I also thought, you know, some of this is some pretty good stuff, and in any case, it's all completely useful, and we are just sitting on it. We already took, you know, enough things to remember them by. And then the alternative struggle was, but it belonged to the family. Mm. And it seems disrespectful to just, you know, we're not going to put it out on the sidewalk. And that was what led us to the auction.
And you mentioned that it was very difficult to go through this auction. You watch mm-hmm. all these things disappear, you know, piece by piece. Describe what that was like for us.
It was really grim. We got there, and the auction was already in progress, and we were part of a larger auction, but most of the stuff was ours. And just to see the pieces go up on the block and see them go down for prices, at one point my sister sort of muttered to me quietly, you couldn't even buy the wood for the price they paid. They maybe paid $300 for this big, really gorgeous vanity. But we did end up keeping some things. Some things just because of sentimental value, even a rather large sofa that might have been valuable, but it was where my mother always plopped down to read her books. And it was kind of like that was my mother's home. I just couldn't let it go.
This whole notion that you talk about in your book, these objects of our affection, it certainly prompted me to look around at all the stuff that I have accumulated over the years. Did writing this book change the way you look at everything around you in your life and maybe wonder where it might end up?
It did, totally. And I'd love to know more about what you thought about your own things.
I have way too much in every little corner.
Closets you didn't even remember you
right.
had.
I don't even want to go up into the attic anymore.
Exactly. Oh, the attic. God forbid. I can't look at anything now without thinking, I don't want to do this to those who come after me, notably my son. I do not want to leave a bunch of stuff for other people to have to sift through. I want to really deal with it myself and have a clear idea about what's really useful and what's really necessary and what are the few things I would like to allow myself for my emotional satisfaction and not to have everything invested with that emotional feeling, to be clear that these things can go anytime, they're just useful, and these few things are my treasures.
Lisa Tracy is the author of Objects of Our Affection, Uncovering My Family's Past One Chair, Pistol, and Pickle Fork at a Time. Thanks so much. Enjoyed the book.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
And finally, we're not usually big into regret on this program. 2020 hindsight really doesn't do anybody any good. But remember how I mentioned earlier about the crazy run on iPads last weekend? $500 to $800 for the latest gizmo from Apple? Well, what if instead you used that same money to buy two or three shares of Apple stock at about $235 a share? How mighty would your orchard grow? Well, a student at UC Berkeley, Kyle Conroy, has been mulling over this idea. And if you follow his logic, it is time to put down the gadgets and embrace the shares. Conroy reached all the way back to 1997 to see what kind of money you'd have now if, instead of buying a laptop, you'd invested its retail value in Apple stock.
If you had bought a Apple PowerBook G3 250, it was originally priced at $5,700. And today, in stock value, that would actually be $330,000.
Yes, $330,000. And that original iPod that Kyle just had to have in 2001, when Apple stock was going for just $9 a share?
It was $300 when I bought it, and that would have translated into about $7,000.
No regrets, though. That iPod gave him years of tunes on the go. And for all you early adopters out there who shelled out $500 for the first iPhone, if you'd invested that amount instead, you'd have almost tripled your money, enough to buy 7 of today's iPhones. Now, Conroy claims to have no interest in the iPad, so we put it to him this way. A new MacBook or Mac stock?
Maybe I'll buy a MacBook Pro and some Apple stock.
Ah, the heart wants what the heart wants. Conroy's blog lists how all Apple products translate into stock gains. We've got a link at marketplace.org. Anybody want to do the math on a Commodore? That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, rich or penniless, some things never change.
You know, I tell them all the time, look, if you save $5, you did more than you did yesterday. Watch and see how good you'll feel in 5 months when you have 25.
Personal finance lessons on Skid Row. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. Love you, Mom. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.